You are listening to Social Europe Podcast. We discuss cutting-edge thinking on politics, economy, and employment and labour with some of the most thought-provoking people around, including Nobel Prize winners and other internationally acclaimed experts. So welcome and enjoy the conversation.
Hello everybody and welcome to Social Europe Podcast episode 41. My name is Henning Meyer, Editor-in-Chief of Social Europe. Today I'm in conversation with Will Marshall, who is the President and Founder of the Progressive Policy Institute in Washington, D.C. and Will also serves on the Board of Directors for the National Endowment for Democracy. We are talking about progressive politics and populism in the United States and Europe. I hope you enjoy the conversation. Right. Will Marshall, thank you very much indeed that you're taking the time out of this very busy conference to have a talk with me about populism and progressive politics in the United States and in Europe. And as a sort of warm-up question, let me ask you something about the United States. I think one of the topics that was mentioned here before is that there is a geography of populism. Yes. So, If you look at the United States, what is happening there? Are the coasts moving apart, and are the Midwest is the flyover country, what is sometimes being called?
Yeah.
Is the politics drifting apart?
Well, yes, it has been for some time. First, Henning, it's a pleasure to see you and talk with you about all this. Yes, I mean it really began a long time ago, but it became pronounced during the Obama years. Interestingly enough. The Democratic Party's support just eroded dramatically across the broad middle of the country, even as our support in big cities and in the coastal states, Northeast Coast and the West Coast, rose. And so you do have, geography is very important in understanding American politics. It's a big country, and there really isn't one way that a political party can approach the electorate, because the voters are quite different in different parts of the country. As it happens, the kind of things you say to voters in, say, California or New York or Massachusetts on the coast is different than the way you talk to voters or run for office in Michigan or Ohio or Iowa. And we sometimes forget that. We assume there's one script that all Democrats or all progressives can follow. And conversely, that all conservatives and all Republicans can follow is not true. You have to appeal to very different people with very different kinds of approaches.
And is it really the geography? Is it more like a division between rural areas and the cities? I mean, look at Chicago, for instance. Right. Would Chicago be more like New York and LA and San Francisco, or more like the Midwest?
It's geographical and it's demographic. The geographic differences are between the coast and the interior, and particularly between the big cities and the ex-urban and outlying areas in the countryside, which are deeply conservative these days. And that's where the heart of Donald Trump's support is found. The demographic change, the demography of the situation is, unfortunately, it cleaves along racial lines, that the Republican Party is now the party of white ethnic identity, whereas the Democrats are a very diverse party. And the Republicans, almost embarrassingly, look like America in the 1950s. They don't seem to be embarrassed by it, but they should be. But that's another cleavage that grew deeper during the Obama years, unfortunately. So it's both demographic and geographic lines of division that now explain a lot of American politics.
Yeah, and I mean, if you go into the reasons for this, let's call it the populist surge, and I mean, the most analysts point to a mixture of economic and cultural factors. So, you know, where would you see in the different areas? I mean, you know, in the cities and in the rural areas, where would you see how are these economic and cultural elements playing out?
Well, it's complex is the short answer to the question, and I'll try to make it simple. My view is that the immediate causes of the populist revolt that elected Donald Trump were more animated by cultural concerns than economic ones. There's been a lot of great analysis of the 2016 election, and people's economic conditions did not correlate strongly to the way they voted, so that the Trump voters were not particularly economically anxious or stressed any more than anybody else. But they were stressed by questions of race, ethnicity, and religion. So more cultural factors. But it's complicated because clearly these same voters, white working class voters in the outlying areas, have been on the front lines of an economic transformation that's been slow and slowly unfolding for decades, really. And it's the shift from a manufacturing economy to a knowledge-based or information-based economy. But that's happened gradually. And so the pain has accumulated over the decades, and it's sort of reached a critical mass in the 2016 election, where a lot of people out in the country believe that they've lost their economic status and role. So the best explanation I can offer is that the prism in 2016 that helps explain why people voted for Donald Trump is one of racialized economics, a feeling among white working class voters that other people were benefiting from national policies at their expense. And it manifested itself in their concerns about immigration, the concerns about loss of national sovereignty and trade and globalization. So it's a complicated formula, and there are economic and cultural dimensions. But I have to say that the analysis that I think is most credible is that the cultural discontents have been front and center in the last 2 years since Trump was elected.
And why do you think that, you know, with Donald Trump in the United States and very similar sort of set of people in the Brexit case of the United Kingdom, that people who are clearly part of the elite are seen as the people breaking this kind of mold, and as seen as breaking the system and sort of being the advocates for changing the current situation for the people who feel aggrieved. So how would you explain that phenomenon?
You mean how does somebody like a billionaire like Donald
exactly? Trump? Yeah.
Well, Trump is a billionaire, and he was born into it. So he's hardly a man of the people, but boy, does he understand the average white American working class person without a college degree. There's just something about the man that he has an affinity for their worldview and knows how to speak to their discontents. It's uncanny in a way. You know, Donald Trump's cultural interests revolve around things like pro wrestling. We've seen that before, where demagogues and populists who are rich get into office. We've seen it with Berlusconi in Italy, and we've seen it recently in the Czech Republic. So not unusual for rich demagogues to learn how to speak to popular discontents. But on the surface, it is a little puzzling because he is anything but one of them. In fact, he makes his living by peddling a brand that is by definition supposed to be exclusive of people like them. They would never get to stay in Trump hotels or fly on Trump airlines.
I'm wondering whether the key frame is basically control, and whether the progressive politics of recent decades, which at least, you know, on the surface seem to emphasize, you know, globalization is happening out there, we need to adjust to globalization. So taking this as an exogenous process that, you know, politics had to adapt to, rather than politics being the transformation force of globalization, you know, for something for the people, you know, taking this taking back control narrative comes up time and time again. And we had several years ago, unfortunately, one of the great sociologists of Europe, Zygmunt Bauman, died, but he was often author for Social Europe. And I remember in one of his videos, he said, nobody seems to be in control. Everything happens at random. The question is, where does it come from? So people just feel left alone with whatever, you know, is happening out there to them, and which might happen in the future. And they're not feeling, you know, the traditional sense of social democracy was always, you know, we help you. We're about emancipation. We help you manage your own life. You know, we are enablers for you to do that. So, well, one of the key things to me seems to be that, you know, that lack of control and the progressive forces, regardless of the policy issues, which we can get into in a moment, don't seem to be able to, you know, have the power to shape things and actually affect a different outcome, rather than saying, you know, this is because that was what was said
in the globalization debate, at least, is happening there, we need to adjust to it.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's clearly a loss of control. I mean, a sense of a loss of control. That's absolutely true. You see that also in Britain around the Brexit debate. The question is, where does it come from? And I think, basically, in the United States, it's not very different than what's happened in Europe. People have turned against both parties, because Trump is not a conventional Republican, not a conventional conservative by any stretch of the imagination. He's a populist. He's different. And he comes from outside of the Republican Party. This is his first time in politics, never ran for anything before, takes over the Republican apparatus. And that's extraordinary, but it shows you that Republican voters were so, Trump voters were so alienated from the Republican Party that they just didn't have any confidence anymore, and they were voting for the maximum degree of change that they could get. And as some people said, they were voting basically to give the middle finger to the establishment in general in the country, the elites, cosmopolitan elites. So it's not just the Republicans, it's also the progressives and the Democrats. I mean, sadly, the Democrats, unlike some social democratic parties in Europe, lost the working class, or at least the white working class, way back in the 70s and 80s. You know, they haven't been with us for quite a while. And so the Democratic Party is socio-demographically more of an elite party, more of a cosmopolitan party, more of an urban and urbane party. And so those voters didn't see culturally, really, in the Democratic Party, an identification. And they didn't think that the Democrats cared about them. And the other part of that story is the rise of identity politics, because if your enthusiasm is for diversity and inclusion, which is a great thing to be for, it's one of the great achievements of the Democratic Party to be the party that brings out groups in. But if that's your sole focus, it's easy for the people who are in the excluded group to say, well, wait a minute, I guess you don't care very much about me. And in fact, I think beneath your discourse about the need to empower minorities is a kind of negative judgment or negative verdict of me. As a white male, I carry too much historical guilt. So people pick that up. And I think that is the most important reason. Look, folks out there who voted for Trump, there's a question of work, a question of dignity. They've lost the work they used to have that gave them middle-class status without having a high degree of education, without having a college degree. But they were able to be solidly and respectably middle-class in the old economy. But they lost that. And along with that, they feel is a loss of dignity. And they think that cosmopolitan elites of both parties, really, Republican and Democratic, disdain and overlook them.
And that's an interesting point. I mean, I fully agree with the dignity point. I mean, you saw that in a recent policy here in Germany about the pension reform or proposed pension reform, which was basically, no matter how low your wage was, but if you worked for decades, your pension should be higher than social benefits.
Yes.
It's just an appreciation of your contribution to society through the work that you've done. So that was also the moniker, respect pension. Mm-hmm. So and I think that worked very well because it really played to this particular feeling that some people don't feel respected anymore,
right,
and not heard. But I mean, on a related issue, you mentioned the working class, and we had some discussions about this here as well. But what is the contemporary working class? I mean, if you look, for instance, we're now in Germany, here in Berlin. If you look at skilled workers in the car manufacturing plants that are still here, they make very good wages. Do they really have economically or socioeconomically or even culturally something in common with, say, a low-skilled hairdresser in some rural part of Eastern Germany or cleaner at a motorway station? So, I mean, isn't it just also the case that within what we used to call the working class, there is a much bigger spread between, you know, the different components?
Well, that's absolutely right. And look, I mean, the discontent in America, pessimism, the feeling of being disrespected and left out and left behind is strongest among the white working class, particularly older white working class men, the ones who used to be the breadwinners, who worked in the factories, supported their families in good middle class fashion, despite not having college degrees, they felt a whole way of life disappear. But the other part of the working class is the aspiring and upwardly mobile Black and Latino in Asian, you know, immigrants and native-born Americans who of color and are Latin ancestry or Asian. These folks are working class as much as anybody else, but they are optimistic. They think things are getting better for them. They see new opportunities for their kids. They suffered terribly in the financial crisis. They lost their homes and their savings and sometimes their jobs. But they see the zeitgeist, the trend is favoring them. They're the up group, and you know, the people who used to dominate the working class, frankly, the old mainstay of the Roosevelt, you know, New Deal coalition, white working class people feel that they are the left behind. Mm. So that's a very powerful emotion out there. So that, you know, if you're a black middle, a black working class person today, you're probably more optimistic about your prospects than a white working class person. In fact, not probably. That's what all the polling shows. Mm.
And so it's not just the matter of, you know, that the jobs themselves are spreading out and, you know, reducing the commonalities amongst members of what we used to call the working class, but also you have, especially in the United States, the ancestry background.
Yeah.
And of course, change is only scary if you're the incumbent, isn't it? if you're the one who's the up and coming, change is in your favor.
Right. Even if you've had some rocky periods, that's true. They just feel like the tide is going in their direction, whereas white working class voters feel that it isn't. And that's a problem for progressives. You know, I come from the school of politics that says, and particularly in a two-party system like the United States, you know, you win by expanding your coalition, reaching out to people beyond your base and your most committed partisans, to independents, moderates, and even disaffected members of the other party. But you also win by dampening the enthusiasm of the other side's most loyal voters, right? You have to give them reasons to think, well, maybe, you know, that's not the answer. And we did better with Barack Obama did better with white working class voters than Hillary Clinton did.
And how would you explain that?
Well, because, you know, contrary to what some may believe, these voters are not bigots. They're not all bigots, and they're not voting primarily on racial grounds. But Barack Obama was the candidate of change in 2008, not Hillary Clinton, who looked like the old Democratic establishment, and in fact probably was. So Obama brought something new and exciting and an outsider status by virtue of the fact that he's the first African-American to seriously contest for the presidency. And so people got excited about, a lot of independents got excited about that. But after 8 years, a lot of them didn't think that their lives were materially improved. And so a lot of them were receptive to Donald Trump. They're also, by the way, more receptive to Bernie Sanders in the 2016 primaries. Bernie Sanders won the independent vote, and it was Hillary Clinton won among Democratic Party voters.
And it's interesting because, I mean, there are two different change candidates that won the recent election. It was Barack Obama for the reason that you mentioned, and then Trump. But I mean, if we just accept the analysis that we talked about previously, that, you know, the economy is changing away from a manufacturing base to a knowledge economy, and the demography is changing, Trump as president won't be able to affect any of this. So this is just happening. So will there be? Is it symbolic politics? Like, you know, okay, just to show that I'm doing something, I'll put a wall up, you know, at the Mexican border, or will people be disaffected? Have a similar judgment after the Trump presidency? You know, nothing has fundamentally changed with me and mine. And we talked about, you know, about what might the next step be. We might not have been down the valley, you know, at the lowest point yet. If that happens, you know, there might be rejection towards the whole political system. We see that in some European countries as well. You said, we tried it with the establishment. They didn't succeed in changing things for us. Then we tried it with several stripes of outsiders, and they didn't do anything with this. So the logical conclusion would be that the whole system as such, the whole governance system might be broken.
True. Although in the United States, you really it's hard to go outside the duopoly, the two-party duopoly. We don't really, third parties never get anywhere in American history, with the rare exceptions. So, you know, that's why, you know, had Trump created a, you know, America First party in 2016, he probably lost, because the structural advantages of the duopoly of the two parties are immense. So they don't, you know, in one respect, they don't have anywhere else to go. That is the Trump voters, unless somehow Democrats can convert them to make them more progressive. And some of them are convertible because they won't have thought that Trump kept his promises. And keep in mind, the vote for Trump was the maximal vote of protest. I've never seen anything like it in close watching of American politics for 40 years. This, you know, voting for Trump was an act of, what's the word? I don't know if nihilism is the right word, but certainly an act of registering the strongest possible protest. As I say, it's the middle finger. I won't do it on camera, but to the political establishment and to the elites. That's what the vote for Trump was. But how many times do you do that? So, you know, if you expected material change and didn't get it, you're going to be less inclined to vote for Trump again. But every time Democrats overreact to Trump, which we do almost every single day, and we've heard that at this conference time and time again, he's dictating the agenda. He does it through media and social media and his Twitter storms. The press colludes, you talk about collusion, the American media colludes with Donald Trump to keep him at the center. And I would say the Trump dysfunction is at the center of political coverage. And so Democrats respond to stuff Trump has done and outrages that he's perpetrated. And to that, to his voters, that's okay. Well, he's making life miserable for the people that we love to hate. So he's our champion. We love him. And the more they're down on him, the more we're going to support him. So there's that dynamic, which he's counting on. But if the Democrats can offer a constructive alternative and say, look, whatever you think about the guy, he didn't deliver. We're not getting those factory jobs back. In fact, it was a false promise. The immigration challenge is worse than ever. And Trump is very far from being able to forge legislative consensus around anything, you know, any difficult problem, healthcare, immigration, climate change, even infrastructure, which everybody is supposed to be for in the United States. He's just not cut out for Democratic politics and passing consensus legislation is not what he does. He's a polarizer. So, you know, I think that should be to the Democrats' benefit in 2020, just as it was in the midterm elections. Remember, we won a lot of probably Trump voters, suburban, college-educated voters, particularly women, in red states and states in the middle of the country, places like Ohio and Iowa and Wisconsin and Michigan, voted for Democratic candidates and gave the House of Representatives back to Democratic control. And it had to be because they were not happy with Donald Trump.
Mm. And you mentioned immigration now. Let's dive a bit into this particular policy area, because there seems to be at least two elements involved in discussions about immigration. One is a perception about immigration. One is what might be real problems resulting from immigration. And you could see that in particular in Europe, I think quite interestingly, because we have this dual system where you have freedom of movement within the European Union, and you have a sort of normal immigration laws for immigrants from outside the European Union. And if you look at what happened during the Brexit referendum, when it was all about taking back control about immigration, sort of in a European movement, you know, one clear fact that didn't make the news very often is that the non-EU immigration into the UK has had for several years been higher than the inner EU migration. Mm-hmm. And obviously, in that section of immigration, there was already full control of the UK government. So they could have reduced non-EU immigration into the UK. Well, they didn't, because what? Guess what? I mean, the economy relies on that type of immigration. even if Brexit happens and, you know, freedom of movement is curtailed or anything like that, the real life consequences, especially if Europeans move away from their jobs in the NHS and the National Health Service, there will be a massive problem in public service provision. Mm-hmm. So in what way is the immigration problem real, and in what way is it a proxy issue for some of the grievances that we already talked yeah. about? But you know, they're it's a symptom
yes.
rather than a cause.
Well, I think it's real. Look, in the United States, it's certainly real. We have a Trump is not wrong that we have a crisis on our border. We do every day. Thousands of people from particularly Central America show up to claim asylum, and they've all been taught exactly what words to say and use in order to be admitted into the United States under our asylum laws. And once they get in, you know, they're supposed to show up later for hearings. Some do, some don't. Most do, but many don't. So, and it's just a humanitarian nightmare down on the border. We don't have facilities for all these people coming in on either side of the border. Mexico is straining under the burden. So there is a crisis, a genuine crisis. Our immigration laws are old, obsolete. They don't make sense. They aren't tailored to our new economy needs at all. Australia, Canada, other countries do a much better job of trying to really bring in people with the talents and skills that are in sharp demand in our economy. So there are lots of reasons for thinking that this policy is completely broken, and that it needs to be modernized, brought into the 21st century, brought into the new economy. And yet, you know, frankly, nobody's really pushing that hard. Trump is making it his reelection issue, the basis for sharpest possible polarization of American society, you know, and claiming Democrats are for open borders and free immigration. And you know what? Some Democrats have fallen into that trap. They've been so traumatized by, or that's not the right word, they've been so outraged by the cruelty and nonsensical nature of the Trump immigration position that they take extreme polar opposite positions. Let's stop border enforcement altogether. Let's just let anybody come in, or let's suspend national immigration laws in our sanctuary cities. And that's not the right answer either. You've got polar extreme positions. So we have, the problem is real in the United States at least, and demands a solution that neither side is as yet serious about supplying. However, it's also symbolic in that immigration looks to be part of this, phenomenon where people are losing social status, people are losing their place in the economy, and then they're told, well, we need these new workers to come in and do these jobs, because our economy needs more labor. And meanwhile, they don't have the good jobs with the good wages that they used to have, and they're worried that their kids won't get those jobs. So it does become, you know, something that the elites tell them we need, and they think, well, no, what we need is for better jobs for our kids. So give that higher priority than the need for, you know, more service sector workers for rich families and more tech workers for the tech industry.
And now moving from the analysis to the easy bit, what can be done about it? So what kind of lessons do you think especially the US Democrats yeah. should learn from this? And what are the cornerstones of a policy program and that could address these pressure points and would be competitive against a person like Trump?
Well, the first thing is you have to do is what the American political strategist at this conference, Pete Broadnetz, said to over lunch. Unfortunately, not enough people probably heard it, but if you don't engage an issue, you can't win the issue. And right now, the Democrats really aren't engaging the immigration issue beyond denouncing the cruelty of Donald Trump's policies. And that's a huge mistake. We have to have an alternative, and one that balances our humane concerns for the well-being of migrants with an affirmation that the American people have the right to determine, to protect borders and determine who comes in on what terms and how quickly, how often. And we don't have that now. After you get that, if we had that, then I think the elements of an actual policy aren't that hard to discern. A lot of think tanks, we've talked about the elements. We probably increase legal immigration. If we were able to get illegal immigration down from a flood down to a trickle, then we could probably get public support for increasing legal immigration, which is both a more humane process for the migrants, and secondly, it helps us tie the migrant flows to what our economy really needs. We would say, particularly focused on job offers. If you had a job offer from a U.S. firm, that would give you a strong presumption that you were ready to come in. We also need to do a lot more, but that's all predicated on stronger enforcement, and not just on the border, but also in workplaces, hiring, stronger enforcement that really gives people confidence that the illegal problem has been, that we're getting it under control. Because remember, we're talking about millions. We have millions of people, almost 12 million illegal immigrants in the United States. But people just decided that's too many. Mm-hmm. And so that, I think, would be one part of the solution, a shifting of the criteria by which we admit people from family unification. You can bring in family relatives to a more skills-based test, I think is probably going to be another critical aspect of a 21st century immigration policy, and a bigger pipeline for legal immigrants. I think those are core elements. But I don't think it's not that we haven't been able to figure out the policy architecture. It is getting a consensus that we need to do both things, that we need to acknowledge that there's a problem, and we need to modernize our immigration laws, which is where the Democrats need to go, with the Republican understanding that we are going to continue to we have demographic shortages in the United States, demographic issues in the United States, just like you have in Europe. We're going to need workers, and that's why a bigger legal pipeline should be a permanent fixture of our general strategy as a country for meeting our economic needs and paying for our social insurance programs and so forth.
I mean, what you outline now is a rational policy reform, but how would you address with politics rather than policy?
Well, but I didn't emphasize politics first. I emphasized affirmations of values, and the affirmations of values that we need now is that we need a humane system for bringing immigrants in that we need, that have always been a great benefit to our society and will continue to be. And most Democrats are there, but we also need an affirmation of the value or the principle that any polity, any democratic society, has the right to enforce its borders, to regulate the influx of newcomers, and decide on the terms by which people are admitted. And that doesn't describe the American immigration system now. People show up. And I'm sympathetic to their claims, but a lot of them aren't truly asylum seekers unless you consider anybody from Honduras or Guatemala or Central American country has a bona fide humanitarian claim. They may have bad gangs, but virtually under that definition, virtually the whole population qualifies. And we can't take them all.
I mean, the point I wanted to make, it was beyond the immigration policy. I mean, what you outline is, this could be cornerstones of a much more sophisticated and better tailored immigration policy. But how should the politics address the pressure points of, the feeling of disrespect of the working class, and the and the feeling of insecurity in the middle classes, that our children might have it a bit worse. I mean, it seems to me that in these days, good policy is a necessary but not a sufficient condition to address this. So how would you sort of, and I think that's where Bernie Sanders also, he spoke to the belly rather than the brain, right? So how can you combine these two things, that you have a good policy agenda that captures that emotional part as well?
Well, first, we have to move the white working class back to the center of our policies. I mean, they haven't been there for two generations. We lost them politically, and we lost sight of them in a governing sense. And so these voters, Trump voters, are not wrong in having reached the decision that the Democratic economic agenda doesn't help them. It's geared to other people and the upward mobility of other people. And so you have to bring them back in, to the center of your economic agenda. And what that means more specifically is a policy that stimulates economic activity and growth and investment, a new job and new company creation in places where it isn't happening, in the places left behind. So the outlying areas, the exurbs, the small towns, the rural areas, the places outside the big cities, you know, in the former Rust Belt, former manufacturing sectors that have not seen any replacement for the great jobs that organized their lives in previous times. So, you know, you have to have a real political economy aimed at bringing them into the new economy. And we think that at PPI, we particularly focus on the digitization of the physical economy. That's what the Germans call Industry 4.0, but it's, it's using information technology, the internet and 5G, to dramatically raise productivity in the old physical sectors of the economy. Our tech companies are doing really well. I know they're controversial in Europe, but they are great job creators and they create good jobs. And they're doing that all over the landscape, but mostly in bigger cities, just now beginning to spread to the rest of the country. But if you could get this marriage of information technology and the physical economy, auto, steel production, production of all things, then you would have a better chance of seeing people outside of the big cities benefit. And that's what we've got to do. And that means committing real resources so people see visibly in their community new jobs being created. We've been talking about manufacturing startups. When people think about startups, they think about some software or coding group or some app developer. And we've contributed to that because we've done a lot of work on that. But we're seeing the possibility for manufacturing startups in the old industrial heartland, which can really, I think, be a political game changer. Secondly, has been said, Jack Markell, Governor of Delaware, said it earlier here today, we don't have a robust system for making sure that the children, that the young people on the wrong side of America's diploma divide, that is non-college going young people, we don't have a system that helps them get high order skills that will lead them into middle income jobs. And instead, we hear a lot of talk about free college from our friends on the left wing of the Democratic Party, which is almost an insult to many of those voters in middle America. They're saying, free college? My kids aren't going to college. They're not getting four-year degrees. You're telling me I need to pay higher taxes so that the more privileged kids who do go to college and get a four-year degree and get much higher lifetime earnings as a result, I'm going to subsidize their college educations to an even greater extent. I mean, it's so tone deaf. Words can't describe how tone deaf that point of view is, and yet you hear serious Democrats arguing for it in this presidential cycle. But to people out there in Iowa and Ohio and Michigan, it sounds like a complete, a perfect elite conception of what should happen and nothing that's going to help their lives.
Before we get to the transatlantic dimension to finish this off, I think this is a very important point that you mentioned. I had a similar experience of that in the United Kingdom, where during the Tony Blair years, the aim was getting 50% of each year into university. And even the cleverest policymakers in the government then later admitted, well, but we never had a really good idea what to do with the other 50%.
Right, exactly.
And I think some of the resilience of the German political economy has actually been this apprenticeship system. Even though there is the tendency of academization here as well, where businesses are having trouble actually finding apprentices.
Yes.
But the idea, it's very similar to what you describe as sort of manufacturing startups. Because what this sort of quite elaborate and extensive apprenticeship system does, it makes manufacturing jobs more knowledge intensive and therefore more resilient.
Mm-hmm.
So it's they are higher added value jobs, and hence these jobs are also much higher paid than manufacturing jobs elsewhere. So
higher productivity and higher wage.
Yeah. So maybe the idea of using that startup mentality for some manufacturing to create something new, but at the same time, flank it with an apprenticeship type system that makes these jobs more knowledge intensive and hence more resilient going forward. That might be a good strategy beyond the I'd still think it's a good idea to get tuition free school for students, but it shouldn't be the only policy. You have to have a policy for the 100%,
yes,
not the 50%.
Right, and in our case, it's for the 60%, not the 30%. But federal policy is tilted dramatically in favor of the 30% who get college degrees and not for the two-thirds who don't. So there's a palpable discrimination or bias in policymaking toward the people who are going to do the best. So it's a policy that's well-meaning. You know, it used to be, you could still say it's a progressive policy because a lot of that money goes to low-income people who are going to college. So it's progressive in that sense. But it doesn't, what we don't have in this country is a robust alternative workforce upskilling and credentialing system. PPI, we did our first report, research paper on the apprenticeship system in Germany in 1991. For decades, people have been talking about how great the German system is, and it is great. It works beautifully in Germany. We can't, we've had real difficulty importing it to the United States for all sorts of cultural and economic reasons. And so we would, we're looking at variations on the theme, though, where, private organizations and even for-profit firms are beginning to enter the space between high school and the employers who are looking for workers who have a little more skill and specific skills that people didn't get from high school. How are they going to get what they need to add value and get better paying jobs and get these jobs that are going begging? We have a real skills gap in America. Mm. A lot of good jobs available and they can't find workers. And that requires a big public investment. So there's a role for progressives to play, a major part in equalizing opportunities across all young people, not just those who already, are going to be better off because they're going to college.
I mean, it's interesting how this interaction is between the sort of, as you mentioned before, the values of the middle class, being the respected person in their job in the middle class. I mean, one of the problems of applying an apprenticeship system in the UK was that, you have a much lesser social, not value, but, because there is a lack of an apprenticeship system, let me start this way, is the level of that job is seen as much lower than it is, compared to university level education. Yeah. In Germany, it's different because mm-hmm. if you say you're a carpenter, you run your own business, this is also a socially well-regarded job as well.
Right.
And the way when Boris Johnson was still mayor of London, I remember a campaign, he wanted to get around this and he called his apprenticeship system the University of Work. Why? Because he wanted to have the ring of the university.
I like that.
Yeah, but, well, it failed for him. He might become prime minister, so it didn't fail for him personally.
Right.
But that was one way of trying to, how can you change the system?
Yes.
Because it transitioned the system from where we are to where you want to be. Because if you create this more knowledge intensive manufacturing job, that's a way of pride. Once you've passed the apprenticeship, that's social status being bestowed on you.
That's the point. Right now, we have a crappy, frankly, job training bureaucracy in the public sector. Nobody has any confidence in, which is why I'm not proposing a big expansion of the public sector's conventional job training workforce development programs because they aren't very good. And nobody has any belief in them, and so they have no cachet. If you get a credential from them, their employer doesn't regard it highly. That's right. That's why I say an alternative to college, because it has to have a system that valorizes your work and the credentials that you earn. So when you get out, you've got the cachet of a real skilled worker, and not And you're right. We need to bring that up to parity with what you get out of college. Maybe it'll never get quite that far, but right now, nobody has, right now there isn't a sense that there's a sense if you don't have a college degree, you're sort of, you lack education because we don't have the high quality skill credentialing kind of programs that we need.
But if you had this would create a social value for the people who are having it as well.
Absolutely.
So we already mentioned, and that's sort of finishing off, it's time flies when you're having fun, it's been 45 minutes.
Uh-huh.
We already mentioned a lot of examples that are, from the UK, from the United States, from Germany. going forward, I mean, there's an obvious need to develop progressive answers to many of these questions. But going forward, where do you see the transatlantic role? Mm-hmm. Some of the things that we're trying to kickstart here at this conference in Berlin. So where do you see, what are the activities, where could the policy collaboration be? So where do you see this going? Yes.
Well, look, I've already heard a lot of great ideas here that that we could use in the United States. You gave me one, this notion of a benefit that is higher because it reflects your work contribution. That's exactly right, because that's working Americans don't really want handouts. They don't really want welfare. They want something that they earn. And so framing benefits in that way is important. That's why everybody, including Donald Trump, is talking about expanding Social Security, because it's seen as an earned benefit, Social Security in our system, our retirement program for seniors. But, you know, there are fiscal problems it has, but it's because it's sacred, because it's seen as earned, not a giveaway program. So that is an important insight that, you know, we can take back. I think, you know, I hope that the challenge of the cross-fertilization of ideas and just talking about our mutual dilemmas, you know, certain conclusions, it drives you towards certain kind of conclusions about values and policy. And it always begins with values. And I frankly think, you know, the center-left parties in the United States and Europe have forgotten how to appeal broadly. That's why we're out of power in most places, or eroding, seeing our parties erode even where they're still in power. And that's a politics of persuasion. That means going into places where you're not comfortable. That means talking about issues like immigration that you don't really want to talk about. It means engaging voters on their terms, where they live, not on what your party thinks is the exact right view. So it means being a little uncomfortable, getting out of your, I hate this cliche, getting out of your comfort zone, but that's what it entails that. So I think to the extent that we are mutually inspired by the dilemmas that we face to do things we wouldn't ordinarily do, to reach out to voters we wouldn't ordinarily think about, that's mutually reinforcing, and we can get moral support, political support, intellectual support, actual practical governing ideas from each other that can be translated to our respective cultural and economic context, which are very different, but we can feel as though it's one movement to create a more robust progressive answer to this this retrograde nationalism that's stalking the Western world, not just the Western world, you know, it's Asia and South America as well. So that's what I hope we can get from this conversation, which I hope is only being launched today and not concluded.
Well, Marshall, thank you very much. I sincerely hope that this wasn't our last conversation. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. I mean, that was a great interview. I really enjoyed that.
Thank you very much for listening. We hope you enjoyed it. Make sure you don't miss future episodes by subscribing to Social Europe Podcast. You can also read our articles on www.socialeurope.eu and follow us on Facebook and on Twitter @Social Europe. Until next time.